Hey, Trey here. Two things. First, I'm not sure if you know it, but Us and Them was honored with four Associated Press Broadcasters Awards, including one for excellence in public service through journalism. Second, it's the time for the Spring Pledge Drive at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And if you value the work that our Us and Them team does in telling the stories about the things that divide Americans, would you consider making a pledge of support to West Virginia Public Broadcasting? You can call or text to 1-800-RADIO-87, or you can go online to WV Public and find the little red button at the upper right-hand corner. And when you pledge, let them know where you live and that you're a listener of Us and Them. Doing this would be a big help for our show and the other great programming at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And thank you so much. Hey, I'm Trey Kay, and you're listening to Us and Them, the show that tells the stories of America's culture divides. The U.S. government's history with indigenous people could be seen as North America's first chapter of Us and Them. As Europeans arrived, there was competition for land and resources. Hundreds of treaties helped the United States expand, but they resulted in broken promises with many tribes and nations. Native people were forced from their traditional lands onto reservations. Over the next century, there were a variety of programs designed to strip Native people of their culture and language. Then, in the 1950s, the federal government changed course. Native Americans were lured away from reservations to cities. They were promised jobs, housing, and good schools. But the benefits of this new urban lifestyle did not materialize. Though the U.S. government's relocation program ended in the early 1970s, there is still fallout from that policy. Many Native families still struggle to find a permanent home. In this episode of Us and Them, I talked with reporter Max Nesterak about his American Public Media documentary, Uprooted, the 1950s plan to erase Indian Country. Max told me he first learned about the government's most recent relocation policy when he was reporting on a sprawling tent city next to a freeway in Minneapolis, Minnesota. In the fall of 2018, most of those living in that camp were Native American. They called their makeshift home the Wall of Forgotten Natives. Max went to that encampment every day, for months.
The tent city looked like tent cities that you'd see on the news from Los Angeles or Seattle or Washington, D.C. But soon, this very Native American identity emerged that you could see even from the highway. You could see two teepees towering over dozens of tents spread out in either direction. People built wigwams out of sticks and covered them with tarps. People went through the encampment at least once a day, burning sage or cedar or sweetgrass to purify the place. There was drumming, there was singing, and it was a community.
Well, what did you learn about why many, if not most, of the people living in this tent city were Native Americans?
Well, I learned that this was a problem that Native people had been dealing with for generations that preceded the focus that we have today on the housing crisis. That back in the 1950s, the U.S. government began moving Native people to cities and didn't provide adequate housing, didn't provide adequate job training or jobs. And for generations, people had been in this area of Minneapolis and hadn't been able to get a foothold.
As I listened to your documentary that's called Uprooted, there was a definite aha moment for me. And I understand that it happened to be an aha moment for you as well. And that's when you heard Sam Strong.
I'm Sam Strong. I'm here representing the Red Lake Nation.
Yeah, so he's a tribal secretary of Red Lake, and Minneapolis had a city council meeting, and they were trying to decide what to do with this encampment. And there were activists and representatives from tribes across the state of Minnesota. So there were people from Leech Lake, Red Lake, White Earth, and Fond du Lac. These are Ojibwe tribes. And Sam was there. He got up and said, look, you know, there's a reason why so many of the people living in this tent city are Native American.
In the 1950s, they relocated Natives from reservations to Minneapolis and other urban areas. It was a termination policy. And obviously, it didn't work. But what it did do was it created a segment of our populations that are here in the cities that for decades and decades have experienced homelessness.
It was an aha moment for me that said, okay, this points to a specific historical event that can help explain why Native Americans are disproportionately likely to experience homelessness. So that's why I started looking into it. What I found is that there was this federal program that really did uproot people from their homes and put them in an unfamiliar environment without any of the support that would really help people access the kinds of things they were promised by the Bureau of Indian Affairs: good housing, good jobs, good schools. It really was, as one BIA commissioner later called it, a one-way ticket from rural to urban poverty.
You mentioned a group called the BIA. What's that?
Yeah, so the BIA is the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is a federal agency that still exists today that's responsible for managing the federal government's relationship with some 573 Native tribes.
And I'm just curious, like, how was there like an initial push, like a radio spots, and it was in the 1950s, so I guess they might have had like newsreels or something like that too, and then visits to the tribes to encourage them to, I guess, buy into and get into this relocation program?
The federal government experimented with relocating Native people to cities around 1950 with the Navajo and Hopi tribes. They had just experienced a severe winter, blizzards that killed livestock and left many people stranded. It was a natural disaster, and it received so much media attention that the federal government felt pressured to act. And so, in addition to flying in food sources, one of the solutions they came up with was to move people to cities.
How was this program marketed to Native American people?
The Bureau of Indian Affairs marketed it by sending BIA officials out into reservations across the country. So it was word of mouth. They had pamphlets. They even had commercials. They showed Native people in Chicago and elsewhere who are well-dressed, who have good-paying jobs. It shows them, you know, you could be a foreman or a chef or even go to business school. So in addition to some very low-budget pamphlets that looked to be hand-drawn by, you know, a bored BIA official, there were also highly produced videos that were pretty convincing propaganda.
Were there some tribes that were targeted specifically to participate?
I'm not aware that any tribes in particular were targeted for relocation. This is something that was opened up to tribes across the country. I know that it may have gone hand-in-hand with termination, the word the federal government used for actually dissolving a treaty it made and saying you are no longer a sovereign nation in the eyes of the federal government. Your reservation will just become part of the United States. It'll be taxable. There is no special identity or political identity.
Hey, Max, I was really interested in the portion of your documentary that featured interviews with several Native American families who told about leaving the reservations and relocating to cities. I'd like to listen to some of that, and then we can talk more about it on the other side.
Okay. Doreen Day was born in 1959 in northern Minnesota near the Net Lake Reservation, also called Boys Fort. Like most reservations, Net Lake is remote. There weren't many jobs in the area. or stores or schools. The roads were terrible. Doreen was the youngest of 17 kids, and she remembers how physically strong her mom was.
She hauled wood, she cut wood, she hauled water, she hauled clothes down to the rapids to wash them and then hauled them back home to hang them up. You know, my father was a hunter-trapper. He was like the best trapper in our area for many years.
Doreen's older sister Sharon says the kids helped with everything.
We picked berries together during ricing season. If you're old enough to rice, you riced.
Harvesting wild rice was a big event. Kids wouldn't go back to school until the season was over at the end of September. They also learned to fish and catch rabbits.
My dad taught us how to set snares. Then it was up to us.
He built birch bark canoes, toboggans, snowshoes.
Share stories with us about our history and the migration story and all of those things, drawing them on the ground.
He could sing Indian music all day and all night, and he'd never sing the same song twice.
He never had a drum. I don't know why. But he would turn the coffee can over, Arco coffee can, and then he would sing, and then we would dance.
One day, when Doreen was 4 and Sharon was 12, their dad came home and told the family about an offer he'd received from the BIA to move to Cleveland, Ohio.
And it was posed as a question, like, should we do this? And then he gave all of the, you know, the information that he had, that the Bureau of Indian Affairs had said there were many people from Net Lake living there. He would be given a job as a heavy equipment operator. Life would be good.
So we went off on a train to Cleveland, Ohio.
It was like this luxurious, grand adventure, right? And there were so many people and, you know, bustling and going and the lights.
And after we got there, we were placed in the ghetto.
Into a, it was a fourplex. Yeah.
Like a living room, dining room, kitchen, and two bedrooms on the side with a bathroom.
There were 8 of them at this point in a 2-bedroom apartment. During the day, their dad went out looking for work. And because it was summer and there was no school, the kids stayed at home.
They didn't let us go anywhere. We couldn't, you know, we couldn't, they were very, like, protective. And, you know, this is all, you know, my mother, I don't believe, had ever gone very far, maybe Duluth.
Doreen's dad didn't get a skilled construction job. He also didn't become a foreman or a chef at a fine restaurant.
My dad was hired as a dishwasher.
And all the other Native people the BIA had said were in Cleveland?
Wherever the other Indians were, they weren't near us.
The Day family story fits a pattern that was being repeated all across the country with tens of thousands of Native families. First, the promise.
There'd be more jobs there and more opportunities.
Yeah, if you want to go to school, you want to get a job.
It was Chicago and Oakland and
Kansas City.
Denver, I think.
Frisco. Minneapolis, Chicago.
The schools were wonderful and jobs were plentiful and all of that.
Then, the shock.
I mean, there was billions of people there and nobody slept, it seemed like.
Using a light switch, that was, I mean, it was, to me, I was scared of electricity. I wouldn't go on elevators.
Kids there who were not Indian, I mean, that I've never seen before.
And then, disappointment and hardship.
Couldn't find jobs, couldn't find work because of the racism.
Of course, without a job, you couldn't afford the rent.
What we end up doing is, like, during the summertime, we would actually live in the park.
There was not enough housing for anybody, much less Indian people.
It seemed like everybody wound up coming back.
After about a month in Cleveland, Sharon and Doreen's parents wanted to go back, too.
I don't think that was a family vote. I think they just decided, like, you know, no, we're not staying here.
It sounds like much of what was promised didn't materialize. Based on your reporting, how common was that experience?
You know, depending on whose statistics you believe, the majority of Native people ended up returning to the reservation from the city. Now, because the federal government wasn't funding or actively trying to improve conditions on reservations, lots of people turned around and relocated again. So lots of people went on relocation 2 or 3 times and tried out different cities. Now,
so wait, I want to make sure I got that right. So basically, they relocated to a city and then made their way back to a reservation. And then things at the reservation were not so great either. And so then they would, take money and funds again to move back to the city?
That's exactly right. There are anecdotes. I read anecdotes of at least one person who used relocation to go on vacation, got to travel and see the country. But for most people, especially families, parents with kids, they were really trying to figure out how to do the best by their family. And if Cleveland didn't work out, then maybe San Francisco would. And if San Francisco didn't work out, maybe Minneapolis would. So people were doing their best to find the best life that they could. You know, people want jobs, they want housing, and they want schools. And all of those were severely lacking on reservations.
Well, what was it like when families returned back to the reservation?
People intended to move forever. The BIA even had people sign a pledge saying they would stay in their destination city forever. And so once you get your mind around moving for good, I think it's really hard to then say, hey, this didn't work out, we have to go back. You know, I think that back and forth between the city and the reservation is something that continues today. Some people who were living in the encampment ended up going back to the reservation or coming back here. People continue to go back and forth, and that's why Minneapolis became a popular city for many Native people to live, because it's so close to reservations.
One thing that I just want to make sure I'm clear about, why was it that the government was intent on relocating people from reservations to cities and then keeping them there? I mean, what was the motivation?
I would say in one word, assimilation. The U.S. government believed that Native people had to assimilate into white American mainstream, both for their own good and the good of the country. So in an oral history, the head of the BIA at the time, Dylan S. Meyer, said, you know, in 500 years, I don't see there being an Indian problem like there is today, because Native people will intermarry with other races and they'll kind of disappear that way. The white American mainstream believed that Native Americans were dying out and wouldn't culturally exist into the future. So why not just help them along and move them into cities? There's also a land grab aspect to this, because hand in hand with relocation came the dissolving of treaties. More than a million acres left tribal control in the 1950s and 60s through termination. And on reservations, there was oil and gas and uranium and timber. So by liberating Native people from their tribal communities and turning into private property that could be taxed and exploited, it also benefited corporate interests.
Despite repeated attempts to assimilate Native people, they have survived and worked to maintain their culture. Coming up, Max Nesterak explains how federal policies from the past may affect future generations.
It's the idea that traumatic events a people may experience can actually be passed down through the generations and manifest themselves later in heightened rates of mental illness, alcoholism, even physical health problems like diabetes or high blood pressure.
That's after this break.
Music lifts us up and brings us together, even when we can't get together in person. Mountain Stage brings you live performances on the air, online, and in our podcast. They remind you how it feels to be in a live audience listening to live music. This is Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage. Find a link to our stations and our podcast online at mountainstage.org.
I'm Trey Kay, and you're listening to Us and Them from West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX. This program is supported in part by the West Virginia Humanities Council and the CRC Foundation. I'm talking with reporter Max Nesterak about his documentary for American Public Media called Uprooted, the 1950s plan to erase Indian country. The relocation program finally came to an end in 1973 when then-President Richard Nixon put a stop to it. He said instead of putting money toward helping Native people in cities, investments should go to reservations. 2 years after the relocation program ended, Congress passed the 1975 Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. It officially shut down the U.S. government's efforts to terminate treaties. While decades have passed since those destructive programs ended, Max says some Native Americans still suffer what's called ancestral trauma.
That's a term that was coined by a Native American scholar. It's the idea that traumatic events a people may experience can actually be passed down through the generations and manifest themselves later in heightened rates of mental illness, alcoholism, even physical health problems like diabetes or high blood pressure. So this is kind of a burgeoning area of research. And what I heard from people is that they know that they are living with trauma and they've experienced trauma in their own life, whether that means having to move from the reservation, the land that you wanted to stay on, or whether it meant having to live in substandard housing in a city and go to a school where you didn't speak the language or nobody looked like you or teachers told you your culture, your identity, your way of being was wrong. You think about what effect that has on a population which generation throughout generation has had some massive upheaval, some policy that has tried to destroy you and make you something different. You can understand how that may have helped contribute to the higher rates of homelessness, domestic violence, addiction, and other things we see in the Native American population.
I was interested to hear that you connected with Sam Strong of the Red Lake Nation and Ojibwe tribe. And he's the guy who initially mentioned the relocation program at that city hall meeting that you went to. I want to hear your conversation with him, and then we'll talk about it afterwards.
Okay. Sam is 35 years old. He wears his hair in a long braid down his back. Today he's got on a Red Lake Warriors basketball jersey to support the girls' team playing in the state tournament in Minneapolis.
So yeah, we shut down. You know, it kind of seems like a weekend here, huh? Everyone's down supporting the girls.
The reservation covers about 1,300 square miles of forest and most of Red Lake. As we drive, you see ice fishing tents dotting the frozen lake to the horizon. Sam points out the building where the tribe processes the million or so pounds of walleye pulled from the lake each year.
I remember when I was a little kid, I would look up at the maps. Red Lake is so large that it's actually represented on most maps, which is awesome. Because as a little kid, you always looked for it and, you know, always thought, hey, that's where I'm from.
Sam didn't grow up on the reservation. His dad went on relocation to Los Angeles in the 60s and then moved to Minneapolis, where Sam was born. Shortly after, they moved to North Carolina, where Sam grew up. Sam's path back to the reservation started when he was 16 years old and entered treatment for drug and alcohol addiction in North Carolina. It was a culturally specific facility run by the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians. And an elder there said he should go to Minnesota and work for his own tribe.
16 in a treatment center, he said, you know what? I want you to be a planner. I want you to go back to your people and plan out your community in a way that is respectful of our traditions. And I know you can do it because I see that you have respect for our people and our way of life, but you also understand how to work in today's world, and you can combine those two. And so I became a planner based off that lesson from an elder when I was 16 years old.
Wow. But a planner seems like an oddly specific thing for an elder to
point out. Yeah, it's crazy, right? And then I did it. That's even the crazier part.
After treatment, Sam finished high school and then got accepted to Cornell University.
My first summer after going off to school, I came back and I started to work as a planner in the Tribal Roads and Engineering Department.
After college, Sam moved back to the reservation with his dad. He eventually got a job as the Director of Economic Development. It's only recently, in 2018, that he was elected tribal secretary. It's one of three full-time council positions, along with the chairman and treasurer. It's a challenging job. Of the 5,000 tribal members living on the reservation, 90% live below the poverty level. Most people live in small, manufactured homes spread far apart, which means if you can't afford a car, and many can't, it's hard to get around the reservation, and even harder to get a job. The reservation's remote location also means its casino isn't very profitable. But to see the reservation through Sam's eyes is to see its possibilities.
Yeah, you know, we want to have everything here to thrive. And yes, we want to improve our educational systems. We have a tribal college now, a two-year program. We want it to be a four-year program and a PhD program. We want it to be fully independent. You know, one of our goals here is to be a sovereign nation, totally independent. And by that I mean energy, food, culture, education, and our economy.
Sam Strong is optimistic about the future of the Red Lake Nation. But for now, it's poorer than other tribal bands that have more profitable casinos. Despite that, Red Lake is supporting a new affordable housing complex going up in Minneapolis. The facility will offer housing and other services to Red Lake residents. Max says they continue to travel back and forth between the reservation and the city.
The apartment complex they're building in Minneapolis will have 110 units, but on top of that, they'll also have a health clinic as well as provide mental health and substance abuse treatment, and they'll have a Red Lake embassy there. Sam Strong says you have to look at where Red Lakers live, and a whole lot of them live in Minneapolis. His hope is that this complex will help people coming right out of homelessness, as well as, you know, low-income Native people get a stronger foothold in the middle class and work their way out of homelessness. And his big thing is doing it in a culturally specific way. So instead of having Native people visit a county hospital or get services elsewhere, that they could have that bundled and administered by Red Lake in a way that makes people feel included, that is a place where people will have trust in their care provider, that they'll feel safe, and that they'll feel comfortable returning to. And also a place where people will have expertise and have the historical understanding to know what the special needs are of Native people.
Max, I have to tell you, your reporting sheds light on an experience of Native Americans that I wasn't aware of. And when I hear Sam Strong say, we want to have everything here thrive and that they'd like to be their own sovereign nation, I guess I'm wondering if it's possible. I mean, have you seen any evidence that this could happen?
In every aspect of sovereignty, Red Lake is making progress. They have a few acres of land that they're farming for food sovereignty. They're working toward having more renewable energy resources. They have some houses with geothermal. They're looking to build a solar garden. They're making progress. You know, I was blown away when he said, we want to do this in 20 years. But that is their goal, you know, and Sam Strong's dad was relocated to Los Angeles. And so the reason Sam grew up off the reservation is in no small part because of this relocation program. So to have him move back and say, you know, we are going to chart a future with sovereignty at the center of it, both on reservation land and in the city where our people are, is really quite remarkable.
Max, I feel so much smarter after listening to your thoughtful report about the current situation with one of America's original us and them divides. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
You've been listening to Us and Them. Our team for this show is me, Trey Kay, Marisa Helms, and Kate Smith. Special thanks to Max Nesterak and American Public Media for letting us present sections of the Uprooted documentary. Uprooted was edited by Catherine Winter and mixed by Corey Schreppel. Michael Lipton and Tristan Lozow wrote and performed the Us and Them show music. Mark Lerner designed our logo. The wonderful people at PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the CRC Foundation. Us and Them was originally developed with the assistance of the Mentorship Program at AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio. We'll see you next time on Us and Them.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.